Hello, everybody, to our little podcast. Today we have a very special guest, and we are very thankful that you take the time to join our podcast, Dana Scott. He is famous for many things: Turing Award winner, revolutionized computability theory, set theory, so one of the most productive logicians of his time. And also, he said, and I'm quoting from a lecture you gave in Berkeley, so excuse me for that, accidentally, you became an important historian because you knew all the very important people like Church and Goethe or Pfeffermann, Soloway, and you made a lot of effort preserving some of the inner workings of the history of this logic community that brought us so many things. So thank you very much for joining. And having said that, I hand over to Thorsten for the first question vlog, so to speak.
Hey, folks. Sorry for this little break. Our first season was supported by the Akademie der Wissenschaften in Hamburg. But since this support ran out, we are now looking to crowdfund our little endeavor here. So if you want to chip in and feel particularly generous, feel free to go to buymeacoffee.com/aboutlogic and contribute whatever you would like to. Thanks for your support, and now back to the episode.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dana, for seeing us. Good to see you again. I wanted to start with something about the anti-Blunder calculus. I just saw a note which you written before you started developing this domain theory, where you basically were saying that there isn't maybe not a good sort of denotational semantics for the anti-Blunder calculus, but then you did find one, and maybe you can say a little bit more about this.
Well, one thing that I want to refer people to is for the centennial celebration of Christopher Strachey, I wrote up very carefully how I met him and various developments that took place there. And apparently, sometime earlier, Roger Penrose at Oxford had told him that for his general work on defining programming languages, he ought to use the lambda calculus. Hey. And when I first met him, that's partly the way he was describing things. But at the time, I felt that there wasn't any mathematical model for the lambda calculus that it would connect it up with ordinary mathematical types and ideas and things like that. And so when I came to visit him in Oxford in the fall of 69, I said, we should go back to the work of Kleene and look at functional theory of functionals. Kleene, in the meantime, had wanted to do descriptive set theory and had gone on to infinitary functionals. But in the earlier work, I mean, the good thing that Kleene did was to introduce, under Church, introduce partial recursive functions and formalizing recursion theory there. But then also Kleene spent a lot of time thinking of recursive functionals. And so what I told to Strachey was that let's look at the very specific way in which Kleene defines higher types of functionals. And so that's an article I wrote up at the time for him. It was a version of it was later published, as I indicate in the notes that I'm sharing with you. And it was after thinking about functionals, what occurred to me was that if you can do higher and higher and higher types, maybe you can go to an infinite type. And then the infinite type turned out to be the model for the lambda calculus, because what you do when you have continuous mappings on these infinite types, they're all determined by what happens at finite types. And so You don't have to go, when you get to the infinite type, you don't have to go higher because continuous functionals are already determined on the lower types anyway. You included all the lower types, so everything is already there. So you only need one infinite type. Maybe this was connected with something that I discovered as a graduate student. I studied under Alfred Tarski very much in Berkeley in the early 1950s. And of course, I was very pleased to learn the work that he did on the decidability of Euclidean geometry. And one of the things there was that Tarski felt that in giving first-order theories of geometry, it was sufficient just to use as your primitives betweenness, that is, points on a line, one being between a pair of other points, betweenness, so that defines lines. And then the important thing to define circles and other things, you use equidistance, so that's a four-placed relation, that the distance between the first two points is the same as the distance between the other two points. And those primitives are meaningful and sufficient as a foundation for first-order geometry in any dimension. And so the question that I ask when I was a graduate student is, well, what happens in infinite dimensions? In infinite dimensions, you just use ordinary theory of vector spaces where the distance on them. And so the primitives are meaningful in all those standard vector spaces. And what it turned out was that, again, there's only one infinite dimensional first order theory. Mm-hmm. All the higher dimensions are the same from the point of view of first order logic, and as a matter of fact, you can say that the first order theories of the finite dimensions 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on up converge in a very definite way to the theory of the infinite dimension. There's only one infinite dimensional elementary first-order geometry. So maybe that that business, that the idea that things iron out and then become stable at the infinite dimension was something that was in the back of my mind, which then I then applied to thinking about of the models for the lambda calculus and using Clayney's recursive functionals.
But continuity was already important. This is good. Does this go back to Brouwer, or who influenced?
Yes. Yes, because we want to think about computable things based on the ordinary ideas from going back to primitive recursive functions. So, of course, you just do things a little bit at a time. In other words, everything goes back to finite configurations. And that's at the basis of the definition of continuity. You could think of continuity of functional as being a finite amount of information about a function value. It's already completely determined by a finite amount of information about the arguments that you want to give to the functional. So that's that. That was there from the beginning, and of course, I was totally influenced by work of Clayney and other people about Clayney's theory of functionals.
Yes. So that's the untyped lambda calculus. But if we move to the typed lambda calculus, again, I have got a quote. I don't know whether it's correct, but I think you wrote a note once how the typed lambda calculus should have been discovered. So it was obviously discovered developed by Church and others, I think you emphasize this that a very natural notion from category theory
that category. Well, that became clear later, but It took a dilemma. I mean, starting with algebraic topology and the emphasis that people put on using categories to give general formulations.
Yes.
Then that sort of came back to foundational things like thinking about basic theory of functionals. So that then led to Cartesian closed categories as a simple idea. And so, of course, then we have developments like Martin Lerf type theory and so forth that are very influential are still today in thinking mm-hmm. about foundations for constructive mathematics. And of course, refer people very much to the works of your colleague Martin Escardo
mm-hmm.
in thinking about predicativity and constructive mm-hmm. mathematics, nicely formulated in terms of type theory like that. And so
yes.
that's a good connection to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. How do you view the role of category theory? I mean, you said already category theory first came off the sort of algebraic topology, but then it moved into logic being a foundation of logic. I mean, how do you view the role of category theory? Why was it so successful?
Well, see the thing is, set theory, like Zermelo-Franco set theory, allows arbitrary collections and arbitrary functions and so forth and things like that. But mathematical applications are better systematized in terms of specialized functions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was that understanding that in order to see the coherence of different kinds of objects, set theory and axiom of choice and things like that as too arbitrary, it's mm-hmm. better to sort of think of basic properties, closure under basic properties, and that's what is
mm-hmm.
Formalized, as everyone knows these days, in terms of category theory.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And nowadays, higher categories become very very fashionable.
Yes, well, there's lots of good literature available. Yes, yes.
I mean, I think maybe you would agree that set theory is very much about very concrete encodings, and you would rather like to have more abstract properties of mathematical objects, and then category theory
yes.
seems to be
yes.
the way to
go. Of course, on the other hand, I just heard here in Berkeley lectures at the latest Tarski lecture that there's enormous amount of work in set theory about higher cardinal numbers. I mean, especially influenced by work of Wooden, but many authors mm-hmm. there. Of course, there's very elaborate development of relationships between higher mm-hmm. cardinalities, something that mm-hmm. was, I mean, the kind of complication was unthinkable 30 years ago, but mm-hmm. has really been developed. I do, however, keep asking those people, what applications do you expect of the higher cardinalities? And they hope that an important application will be in better understanding of descriptive set theory,
mm-hmm.
Going back to what Kleene was promoting in his time there. So there's incredible development in set theory, but I'm still wanting to know what are more concrete applications. And so I keep irritating people by asking that question.
It's always good to irritate people.
Yeah, that's true. We stick shortly to set theory, if I may. Mm-hmm. For the audience, I mean, nowadays every set theorist needs to learn the forcing technique. If we normally learn it via Boolean algebras, and all this was developed in California, right? So forcing became the standard technique for set theorists there. But I wanted to ask you a slightly different thing. I sometimes read that already Gödel had nearly something like a forcing argument, something with permutation models in mind, but then decided not to work more in that direction because he feared that this will make set theory to the study of models of set theory rather than set theory proper, so to speak.
Of course, Gödel had many ideas that he never exposed, never wrote up. Another strange thing is Kreisel, who was very close to Gödel. I mean, one of the reasons that Gödel and Kreisel were very close, that Kreisel had studied Hilbert Bernard's book very much when he came to Princeton. Then there was lots to discuss with Gödel, but just as it was with Gödel and Einstein, German language made it very much easier for Gödel to discuss things. Kreisel and Gödel spent hundreds of hours on the telephone talking over things. And of course, they also liked the telephone very much because you can't give out any germs if you're speaking over the telephone.
Oh, yeah.
And Gödel was always worried about his health. But anyway, Kreisel actually had some ideas that could have led to forcing, but it took Paul Cohen to actually come up with it. And one of Cohen's motivations, I've always felt, was that logicians like Pfefferman and people that he knew in Kreisel, or who visited Stanford many times where Cohen was. Cohen was PhD in Chicago, but then he came to Stanford and all of those people. And Cohen really felt that the logicians didn't really get into the correct mathematical ideas. For example, Cohen completely redid for himself Tarski's decision method for geometry. And all of these people talking about analysis, Cohen was going to show them from the point of view of a real mathematician that he could do much better in understanding the consistency proofs and things like that. And so I have the feeling that Cohen never read anybody else's paper. He just proved everything for himself that he needed. He was, of course, very, very brilliant. But then what happened was, after he showed the forcing techniques at Stanford, Salovey, who had been a student in Chicago as well and had a position at Berkeley, came over to Stanford to visit Kreisel and Pfefferman and myself, and to better understand Cohen's work. And so one day he was talking to us, and Salovey pointed out, well, look, I can reinterpret here this kind of Cohen forcing thing by giving a kind of many-valued logic. We can easily interpret his things as modeling set theory in a Boolean-valued logic. So it just happened that over the holidays and at the end of the year, when I was at home thinking about it, I thought to myself, wait, if Salovey can go from Cohen and then reinterpret his definitions as a Boolean-valued logic, why couldn't we turn it around and go backwards and start with Boolean algebras first and then thinking of what axioms of set theory you'd like to achieve, but in order to have properties of the set theory, you have to make up an appropriate Boolean algebra for it. And of course, I had studied under Tarski and his many collaborators a lot of work on Boolean algebras, like the Boolean algebra of Clopin sets in topological spaces. All that came from earlier work with under Tarski and his collaborators. And so I tried to apply those ideas. Another fortunate thing in my development was I had studied point set topology under J.L. Kelly, wonderful expositor, became a close friend in later life. So the influence from the Tarski school and things like Kelly made me try to understand what kind of topological spaces you would need in order to get the right properties of a Boolean algebra of regular open sets in order to do this interpretation of set theory and Boolean band. Of course, after I quickly wrote that up over the Christmas holidays there, Salome said, "Of course, I already knew that. I thought of that as well." So when we had the UCLA set theory meeting in the summer, Salome and I presented Boolean value models together in a joint paper.
Get it?
But I have to try to explain myself for one of my many failures after the UCLA set theory conference. I was on sabbatical in Amsterdam for a year, and Salove was traveling, and he came to meet me. And of course, we had to think of publishing our joint paper on Boolean value models. But in the meantime, the whole thing had caught on so well that people all over the world were proving new theorems over and over again. And Salove kept saying, "Now, our paper has to include this, and it has to include that, and it has to include this. All of these things are happening. You have to put all these things." I was incapable of carrying out the expansion of the thing that Salove did. And so that's why I never finished the paper there. Luckily, John Bell took it up and wrote a very nice expository book on Boolean valued set theory. And so students could study it. But of course, I'm ashamed of myself for not being able to do the publication. I'm also ashamed of myself for never having published a book. I look at my colleagues who write wonderful books, and I never was able to bring myself to organize things there. But I have given some very good lectures, and so that's why I'm recommending to you that you be sure to include with this discussion here the materials for the lectures that I gave you there, because I can point people to things that they should look into, even if I have this whole thing up as a book.
For the audience, you can click on the links in the comment section of this video, and there you can download the PDFs. So it's there, accessible there.
Very glad to hear if people can give corrections or expansions of the things there. I tried to indicate some of the history of development that was connected with these things. So it would be nice if I could get some criticism back for that, so we can improve the overview.
Yes, I think it's quite clear that you're very creative and very productive. And I guess maybe if you had a little sat down and concentrate on a book, maybe we would have lost more than we would have gained. So I think there's nothing to be ashamed of. Yeah.
Well, also with the decade that I had in Oxford, there were excellent students there. And one year I was advising, one semester I was advising 19 graduate students at one time. So I spent an awful lot of time probably with the students. So maybe I can be glad that my contribution has been that I've helped a lot of people on with their research.
No question. Then can I, you already mentioned type theory, and that's obviously something I'm very interested in. So I think if you go back in the past, I think you already also discovered some ideas about dependent types before Pierre Martin Loew developed his type theory. Have you got any comments on this? I mean, you looked at type systems and polymorphisms, and I think there were some examples where you used some notion resembling dependent types before Pierre Martin Loew formulated it. I mean, there were like these theories. I mean, obviously system T and also, I mean, system F.
I mean, it's a simple sort of outgrowth of just higher order logic. So, of course, one thought of first order logic, second order logic, and so forth, going up to higher types there. The thing that's different, though, is usually when you think of higher order logic, you also, if you're doing second order logic, every formula determines a collection. I mean, the comprehension axiom. That's
comprehension. I thought you meant comprehension. Yeah, I was going to say
comprehension axiom is very strong, and of course that makes a very very thick type theory. And so what was interesting is there are so many thinner type theories, and particularly makes better connection with constructive logic. Whereas if you just think in terms of higher order logic, with the comprehension axiom, you're not thinking of it constructively because you're thinking of arbitrarily. I mean, anything that you could express logically determines the collection of things that satisfy that. So comprehension axiom is very strong.
I mean, what I'm thinking about is that if you model higher order logic, you quantify over propositions. But if you want to turn more mundane predicate logic into types, you get these dependent types where you depend, for example, on a number and so on, which is, I think, the core of Pierre Martin Loew's theory.
Yes, and that's what I think that Escarter and Tom de Jong and people are showing very clearly in their work too that's a key way of thinking of things.
Yeah.
So maybe let me ask, do you feel well for another question, or do you think it's better to have a break now or leave?
Well, I think one more question and I will say goodbye.
Yeah, that's very fine.
Can I ask you a question which is close to my heart? I think, if you're interested in constructive methods, this is something many mathematicians are not sort of very aware of, that there is something like intuitionistic logic and constructive reasoning. What's your view on this? It's my feeling that many mathematicians are not really they are not aware of that. Is this other view, the more constructive view of mathematics, and tend to ignore this? What's your experience in this context?
Well, I knew Eric Bischoff very well. He was came from Chicago. That was where I had my first job, and I met him there. And his sister was a brilliant mathematician too. But what happened with Eric Bischoff after doing very amazing things in functional analysis? He woke up one day and said, all these ultrafilters and all these kind of things have no numerical meaning. I remember him saying it has no numerical meaning. And so he wanted to do analysis in a way that had numerical meaning, and he did it without going into it would be his proofs are classically correct, his proofs are intuitionistically correct, and so he's getting at the kernel of constructive proofs there without adopting any kind of special logical ontology the way that Brouwer wanted to do intuitionist there. And of course, then Bishop and his collaborators have carried that out very, very extensively. But I think what the category theory is doing is, and I feel that that's beautifully explained in many papers by Escardo, is that there's a more general view of that kind of constructivism in predicative dependent type theory. And so I think that really is a culmination of the kind of point of view that Bishop wanted to get at, so that he could say with during the tools we use, there really is a numerical meaning to the proofs and analysis that he gives. So I think that predicative dependent type theory is the best modern version of constructive mathematics.
Yes, I can only
but
agree.
I think you know all about it, so.
But it's good to hear from you.
I take it you agree with it. I take it you agree with me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so great. We can only say thank you once more. There's so much more we would love to ask about fixed points, about so many things. But for now, it's more than.
Well, we can meet again sometime. Mm-hmm. Why don't you? And get things from other people too. Why don't you think of some questions to ask, and then correspondence, we can think of the questions, and so then we can have a discussion again later.
Yes, yeah, that absolutely.
Would be lovely.
That would be great.
Okay, thank you, so
thank you
much.
Very much.
Okay. So let me say goodbye, and I hope to see you soon again. Thank you.
Good. Thanks again. Bye-bye.